Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the Mood, Cognition, and Memory call. Your host for today is Ms. Erica Sutton. Ms. Sutton, you may begin.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for tonight's teleconference on Mood, Cognition, and Memory. I am Erica Sutton, Programs and Services Coordinator for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, and it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Roberta Dedale. Dr. Dedale received her bachelor's degree from Westland University and her doctorate in clinical psychology at Boston University. She is a licensed psychologist with a private practice in Houston, specializing in helping patients meet the challenges of loss and major life change, including chronic illness, disability, and cognitive dysfunction. She often works with patients and family members to help them adapt to the social, emotional, and vocational changes and relationship issues caused by disability. Dr. Dedale is also the founder and executive director of Disability One-on-One, a nonprofit organization providing high-quality, consistently available programs to help people with disabling medical conditions and their families learn to adapt and thrive. She also teaches in psychology in the psychology department at Rice University and advises students interested in careers in mental health. She has taught and presented workshops in the continuing studies department at Rice University and the Women's Institute of Houston since 1991. Dr. Dedale is a mental health trainer for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society and currently serves on both the Programs Committee and the Clinical Advisory Committee. Dr. Dedale, I will now turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Erica. Listening to all that, it makes me tired just to hear it. But I am completely entranced by all of the challenges that it takes to deal with a disability, and all that started for me, myself, 38 years ago. I was in an accident and was spinal cord injured, and it left me quadriplegic. So from that time on, I've been kind of fascinated by what enables people to do well under these kinds of circumstances where you have physical limitations and your life becomes much more difficult. So that has been my passion and my interest my whole career. Tonight I want to share a few things that I've discovered both by books and working with people, especially working with a lot of people with MS over the years, and focus mostly on depression and MS, but also want to make sure that I touch on the memory and cognitive difficulties, because sometimes it's difficult to tease apart what's depression from what's a cognitive deficit. And since both depression and cognitive problems are not uncommon in people with MS, it sometimes is overlapping, so it's difficult to figure it out. What I want to start with is just talk a little bit about the prevalence of depression and cognitive difficulties, and then talk about some of the causes, some common symptoms in depression especially, and then how people deal with these kinds of things, the kinds of problems that come up for us, and what we might be able to do about it. As I go along, you're welcome to jump in and ask a question if you want me to talk more about something, but I will leave time at the end, about 10 or 15 minutes at the end, for people to ask questions. So feel free to wait or jump in, whatever you feel comfortable doing. To begin with, I think you may be tuning in because this is an issue for you, whether it's because you have MS or someone that you're caring for has MS, and depression suddenly triggered a bell for you that this is an issue. And you're not alone. The studies, depending on what study you look at, range in terms of rate from 42 to 54% of people with MS at some time in their lifetime will end up with a clinical depression. That's compared to somewhere between 5 and 17% for people without MS. And that's a higher rate than people with cancer or other kinds of chronic diseases. So we suspect that there's something linked to the disease itself that makes people more prone to depression, that it's more than just feeling bad because you're disabled or because you have a chronic illness that you have to manage. And I want to talk a little bit more about that later. The causes of depression tend to be one of two types. They're either biological in that it has something to do with the brain and how the brain is functioning, or existential, meaning having to do with the realities of life that we face when we are dealing with a chronic illness and the losses that are associated with that. I'm going to talk about those causes more in depth in a minute, but before I do that, let me kind of go over what I consider to be symptoms of a true depression. When we're talking about depression here, we're not talking about, I feel blue, you know, I had a bad day. We're really talking about a lot of symptoms in a lot of different areas of your life that cause dysfunction overall, and that it tends to be long-standing. And you may not be terribly dysfunctional, but if it keeps you from living the normal life that you would want to live, then that causes some dysfunction. The symptoms fall into three general areas. One is the professionals call it the vegetative symptoms, and that really refers to the physiological side. And it is a physical disease. When an individual becomes significantly depressed, they often have disturbances in sleep. Either they have problems with insomnia, or they feel like they want to sleep all the time. They're just tired and fatigued. They don't have any energy, lack of motivation, and also lack of ability to initiate. You might have someone who really wants to do stuff, and it's typical for me to be talking to a patient and say, all right, this week you're going to try to exercise three times, and you're going to call a friend once, and they say, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And then the following week they'll come in and I'll say, did you do it? And they'll say, no, I wanted to, but there's just this lack of follow-through that seems to be more than willpower. It's something to do with the brain just not clicking. There are also other kinds of problems, like problems with your stomach and your bowels. Sometimes people will get constipated or have other kinds of difficulties, and that may also be associated with some of the emotional symptoms of depression. Emotional or affective symptoms are things like sadness, which is what we typically think of when we think of depression, but also anxiety is a big common feature of depression. And anxiety brings with it a lot of thought difficulties, worries, what-ifing, a lot of sort of distraction that makes it difficult to concentrate and attend to things, which is part of the cognitive side. But sometimes people also, with the emotional side, instead of feeling more of sadness or anxiety, they actually just feel nothing. They don't care anymore. They feel a sense of numbness, a lack of ability to experience pleasure. You know, you're out doing something with your family and you should be having fun and everybody else is having fun. You're trying to put on a good face, but you really don't feel it. And that's typical of people who are depressed. And the third category is the cognitive side. It's the thinking part. It's how the mood changes, which are really in part biological, also have an effect on how we think. There's a psychologist who has done a lot of research on depression named Aaron Beck. He talked about what he called the negative triad of thinking. It's a negative view of yourself, a negative view of other people and a negative view of the future. So if you have a negative view of yourself, you may feel that you're not worth much, low self-esteem, you don't feel effective, feel kind of inadequate, even though other people can say, but you've achieved so much and you're such a wonderful person, you know, why can't you see that? But you just don't feel it. You don't feel in touch with that. And sometimes feelings of helplessness, guilt that, you know, you aren't doing more or that you're not able to keep up with your responsibilities the way you used to. And those kinds of thinking can also perpetuate the depression, because if you feel helpless, inadequate, guilty about the things that you're not able to do, it can make you feel more depressed, and then the more depressed you feel, the more negative you feel about yourself, and it's a vicious cycle. The negative view of other people usually expresses itself by the belief that other people either don't care, or more often that they don't really understand what you're going through, and so you feel really isolated, alienated, and often people will completely withdraw socially. They don't feel like going out. They don't feel connected to other people. Again, that the mood affects the way that we think. And I think it's also difficult because with the anxiety or the other kinds of difficulties with problems of attention and concentration, slowness of thinking, it becomes difficult to keep up with people and keep up with your responsibilities. So you begin to feel as though you're falling behind. And that, again, becomes sort of a vicious cycle, part of the depressive cycle. So all of that can often lead to feelings of hopelessness about the future. It's never going to change. And even to the point where people can sometimes think about death or think about actively killing themselves. A lot of times, if people are very depressed, they will think, gee, you know, I wish that I didn't have to wake up tomorrow. It's not being suicidal. That's just thinking about how much pain you're in and that you'd like to be, you know, have relief from your pain. I think it can be scary to feel that way and frightening to share that with other people, but often that's the best thing to do to avoid its going to the next level where you actively begin thinking about ways that you want to end your life. And certainly if you feel that way, reaching out is extremely important. It may feel as though other people don't care, but in fact there are a lot of folks around who do care a lot, and so reaching out is important. And if you're a caregiver, it's important if you begin to suspect that people are very depressed to ask a question. You're not going to put something in somebody's mind if it's not already there. Don't be afraid to ask that question. So that kind of gives you an idea of some of the symptoms of depression. And as I was going through them, you might have noticed that some of them have a cognitive aspect to them, more than just how I'm thinking about myself or my situation, but not being able to think clearly. So when people can't pay attention and their concentration begins to go, they maybe can become frightened that they're developing a cognitive deficit related to their MS. And as I say, that is not a terribly uncommon feature of MS, so that gets very scary. It's probably one of the more important reasons why getting this assessed is useful, because it helps you to separate what's a real thought processing problem from what's a depression problem. And since that is difficult to separate, it's a good idea to get somebody in who's accustomed to thinking through those things, maybe even do some testing to see what the problem really is. Let me talk briefly about some of the causes of depression. The biological features of it tend to be genetic in many cases. Even for people with MS where the rates of depression are higher and there may be some disease-related aspects, if you have a genetic sort of predisposition or loading for depression or bipolar disorder, manic depressive illness in your family, you're more likely to be susceptible to developing depression after the onset of MS. And if you've experienced depressive episodes prior to developing MS, it increases the likelihood that you'll experience depression. It probably has something to do with the neurotransmitters, which are the kind of grease that greases the wheel of the neurological functioning in the brain. And serotonin is the most common, the neurotransmitter that's most commonly associated with depression. And we do know that some of the disease affecting treatments are have an impact on serotonin levels, so that if you're taking some of those like beta-seron, for example, you may be experiencing lower rates of serotonin. And for that reason, often neurologists who treat MS regularly will just automatically put people on a serotonin-enhancing medication, which is, we know better as an antidepressant. But that's essentially what it does. And even if you're not depressed yet, it may protect you to some degree from developing depression. There are other, I think, stress-related aspects that may play a role here, because anyone who is dealing with a chronic illness and physical limitations knows that it's stressful to be sick. And it's sometimes even a full-time job to just try to take care of yourself. And stress over long periods of time is known to produce changes in neurotransmitters like serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. All of those are related to or can be related to depression. So when you have experienced long periods of depression, it can actually affect the way that your brain is functioning. So again, taking some medications that will increase or enhance the effectiveness of those three neurotransmitters can be helpful. The traditional antidepressants like Prozac and Paxil work on serotonin, and some of the new ones like Celexa will work on both norepinephrine and serotonin. And then there's a third category that works on dopamine. Those are the ones that you see sometimes on TV. Seroquel is one of them. Geodon is another that will be added to an antidepressant to help to balance the chemical imbalance that's caused by the depression and possibly by the MS. These biological features can be there, but it can also be that if you are in a bad situation for long enough, that can be depressing all by itself. And you don't need the biology to experience a feeling of being overwhelmed by the disease and all of the treatment aspects, changes in your life, the changes to your family. It changes your existence in some very basic ways. One of the things I think that happens is that we all know from a pretty early age, 4 or 5, that we're going to die and that other people die. We understand it intellectually. But when something happens that makes you aware of the kind of vulnerability and the shortness of life, it hits you at a totally different level. And people who haven't been there can't really understand. So it's difficult sometimes even to talk to people about it because they don't totally get it. It's being aware of the kind of vulnerability of human existence that kind of puts us in a situation that is hard to put that on the back burner. It keeps coming up and we keep thinking about it, and sometimes it's easier than others to try to turn that off, and other times it's impossible to turn it off because we're constantly being reminded of it by new symptoms coming up or having to go to the doctor or having to go for treatments. It seems like we can never really escape it. Some of the sort of existential part of the depression is what I was talking about before, of that sense of being alone in this. And we all yearn for people to understand us, and to, especially we're in this kind of situation, we yearn for the sense of comfort that would come from someone really knowing and really being able to touch us on that really personal level. And the reality of it is that ultimately we're all alone. Even if you talk to somebody else who has MS, they're not going to have exactly the same experience of it that you do. And even if they had exactly the same physical condition, which is impossible, but even if they could, they're not you, so they don't understand. And I think it can be overwhelming when you sort of reach that point where you feel so alone with this. And I often think that it's helpful just to be able to say, okay, that's normal. It's normal to feel this way. It's normal to have that sense of alienation. And maybe no one will ever totally understand, but that's okay. You know, they're trying hard, and I want to reach out to them anyway, even though they won't completely understand what I'm going through. I need to let that be okay. It's also, I think, affected by that sense that even though we've done everything right in life, and even though we've been good people and, you know, involved ourselves in the community and raised our children or done things correctly, that it's hard to understand why things like this have to happen to people. And so there's sort of a lack of obvious meaning to why these things happen. And I think it changes our view. It sort of forces us to rethink how we looked at the world, how we looked at our own purpose in life, and reconstruct a sense of our own identity. I think often people experience a disruption in their sense of who they are because in some ways we are what we do. When somebody asks me, you know, describe yourself, one of the first things I say is I'm a psychologist, and that's defined by, I'm defined by what I do. I probably shouldn't be, but I am, and if for some reason I weren't able to do my work, it would really disrupt my sense of identity, and I would have to make a lot of changes in how I see myself. And when I work with people with MS and other kinds of medical disabilities, often they're going through that because they've lost physical abilities and sometimes even cognitive abilities that enable them to do the kind of work that made them feel like they were part of a community and contributing to the family. And now they have to begin looking at themselves differently. We're much more willing to look at somebody else and say to them, you have value aside from how much money you bring in. You have value just by virtue of who you are. We can say that to other people, but do we feel it? Not always. So it's often a real challenge to rethink who you are and try to redefine the ways in which you can contribute. And there are lots of ways to contribute that are new and different and that are open to us, but it's forcing ourselves to think about it and to let go of who we used to be. And that's a real challenge and can sometimes be depressing. It also can be difficult to experience a social change. If we can't do the things that we used to do, often we will lose the people in our lives that we used to do those things with. We've all experienced it. I did too, that you lose friends, you lose family members sometimes who just can't handle it. They don't know how to talk to you. They don't know how to, I suspect they would like to help, but they feel helpless. And so it's easier for them just to turn it off and you know, disappear. And that's really painful to experience that and can be very depressing. Sometimes we have to reconstruct a social group for ourselves. And it doesn't have to be of all disabled people. It just means going out and spending more time with people who don't see us as different, significantly different from them, just because we have some limitations. And there are people like that out there. It's just a matter of reconnecting and getting engaged in what other people are doing. So with all of this going on, what do we do about it? Well, I think one of the first things to do is to, if you suspect that you or someone that you're caring for is suffering from depression or is having some memory loss and you don't know whether it's depression or whether it is because of cognitive difficulties, to go and get a good assessment. Don't be afraid to open up the question with your physician. Often, as I say, neurologists who work with MS patients are very familiar with the fact that depression is common. They're more than willing to prescribe antidepressant medications, and they're more than willing to send you for some sort of assessment that will help you figure out what's really going on. And that's got to be step one, is kind of separating this out, what's really happening. And then the medications, I think, can be useful. It's not that they fix everything, but if you are fighting a biological process that's slowing down your thinking and also making it difficult for you to control your emotions, then taking medications that will help with information processing, that will help with dampening of emotion, of undesirable emotion, really can be extremely useful. And you still have to deal with all those existential issues and the identity change and the social engagement, but it's much easier to do all that if your brain is functioning a little bit better, if you're a little bit more snappy. So I think that medication with other things can really be helpful. In virtually every study that's been done on depression medication and especially cognitive behavior therapy, where people are focused on how you think and how that's related to the way you feel, all of those studies suggest that people who are on medication and also doing some counseling both respond better, they recover better from the depression, and they're much less likely to have a relapse than people who are either on medication or doing counseling alone. So it's a pretty strong kind of support for the idea that medication and working with somebody to look at how this affects your thinking and how you're thinking may be affecting what you're doing. Because as you engage in all that negative thinking and feel helpless, hopeless, begin to withdraw socially, you become disengaged from life. And so there isn't anything that feeds your energy, your enthusiasm, because you're not engaging in life in a normal way. So doing some counseling, taking some medication is helpful, but I really think that it's most helpful because it helps people have the energy and the courage and the desire, or at least believe in the importance of getting out and doing things. And as we make the decision to take action and to get reengaged, even in small ways in life, to become physically more active, to become socially more active, that gives us a sense of renewed competence and effectiveness. You know, we're a part of the world again. We can see, you know, when we come into a room and people are excited to see us, it feels really good. And that increases our sense of self-esteem and self-worth, making it that much easier for us to make decisions to get engaged. So that's a really positive cycle that we want to work on. And you can't get that cycle moving in a positive direction unless you get out and do. And that is probably the bottom line. If you're not able to get out and start being active socially, physically, it's going to be difficult to really recover from the depression. It's difficult sometimes, I think, to figure out where to start. If you have been out of the loop for a while, and I think that sometimes we expect to start, you know, too high up the ladder. We think that the first time we go out of the house, we should be doing something of great import, or able to work 40 hours a week, or that we have a tendency to think in black and white terms about activity. And I think that just getting out, even walking to the end of your driveway, or physically becoming more active, even if I'm in a wheelchair, so I can't walk, but when I am physically active with my arms and shoulders, and get my heart beat up and do some aerobic activity, I feel a lot better. And the studies of people with depression and physical activity suggest that people do recover from depression more quickly and are less likely to relapse if they're physically active. So that's a part of it. And then just taking one step at a time. When I was recovering from my spinal cord injury, I was about, I guess, 3 months into the injury, and I caught a cold, and my respiratory system was not very strong. So the cold quickly turned into pneumonia, and then all of a sudden I found myself in an intensive care unit on a respirator with a tracheotomy. I couldn't speak, and the machine was breathing for me. And the first few days I was so sick that I didn't really pay attention to very much. But as I began to feel better, I began looking around myself. And as you know, those intensive care units are really weird places. You can't tell day from night because there's no natural light in there. There's beeping sounds everywhere. And there's nothing to do. I tend to get bored really easily. And boy, I was really bored. So I started looking around myself, and I noticed that the machine, the respirator, had a small green light on it. And sometimes the light would come on, and then it would go off, and it would be off for a while. And then it would come on, and then it would go off. It would come on, it'll go off. And I couldn't figure out what was triggering it. You know, it didn't seem to make any sense to me. It wasn't a regular, like, every 7 seconds or every 10 minutes. I couldn't figure it out. So when the nurse came in to talk to me, I tried to make some hand signals and ask her what the green light was. And she said, oh, that light, that goes on when you initiate the breathing. So when you're breathing for yourself, the light goes on. When the machine is breathing for you, the light goes off. So I thought, well, okay, at least that's something to do. So when I was bored and not doing anything else, which was most of the time, I started trying to make the light go on. And within about 3 weeks, I was out of the intensive care unit. I was had the trach out. I was back in rehab, and the rest is kind of history. Now, the doctor had told my husband that he didn't think I would survive this, and if I did, I probably would never get off the respirator. You know, I look back on it now, and I think, you know, did I save my life? You know, we know a lot now about biofeedback, which is using machines to give us information or feedback about some life force. And I think I had sort of created a little biofeedback machine for myself. Did that help me? Did it make me stronger, better able to initiate my own breathing? I have no idea, and there's really no way of knowing. And at the time, that was not my intention. My intention was really to do something rather than to do nothing at all. And so for me, that's kind of become my way of life. My motto, I guess, is to turn on those green lights. For everybody, the green light looks different. For you, it's whatever it is that you can do that's in front of you that is better than doing nothing. And it's my belief and it's my observation over the years that if we look for those green lights, number one, we'll find them. And number two, they do tend to lead to things. They do tend to lead to change. And if you're satisfied with not knowing for sure and you're just willing to go on faith and look for those lights and turn them on, it does eventually make things better and bring you to some better place. So I'm going to stop with that thought and open things up to some questions if anybody would like to either comment or add some thoughts of their own or ask me to talk more about some part of this.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if there is any questions you have, please press the number 1 key on your phone now. Again, if you have any questions or comments, please press the number 1 key now. Our first question comes from Lori. Go ahead, Lori.
Yes, I find, and I guess this is probably normal, I find when I'm more fatigued that the cognitive issues are so much worse, the anxiety, the thoughts, I'm not able to think straight. There's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of what-ifs, emotional issues.
And I think that fatigue, you're absolutely right. If you think about your brain as an electrical system, which is essentially what it is, you're having a brownout when you're tired. And you don't have enough electrical energy to make everything run normally. And MS, as we all know, has fatigue as one of its primary symptoms. So it may be fatigue because you've been doing a lot. It may be a sense of fatigue because you're in a depressed state, or it could be the MS. But whatever it is, it's as though you have less energy to draw from. And that means that it's much more difficult to suppress those negative thoughts, to concentrate, to make your brain do what you want it to do. And often what we want it to do is think clearly about what's in front of us and not be distracted by a lot of emotional stuff or worrying. But we can get much more easily distracted when the brain doesn't have enough energy to go on. Any other questions or comments?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if there's any questions or comments you have, please press the number one key on your phone now. One moment while our questions come into queue. We have no further questions in queue. I apologize. One just came in. Our next question comes from Margaret. Go ahead, Margaret.
Do you have any suggestions on things we can do to help our memory?
You know, there's a lot of debate about that, about how helpful this or that kind of activity is. But it would seem from the studies that have been done that the more mentally active we are, the better our memory holds up. And there isn't any evidence that it's actually fixing memory problems, but what may be happening is that when we're actively thinking about things like working puzzles, doing crossword puzzles, even having an active conversation with somebody where taking a class, reading an article, and then talking to somebody about it, all of those things make the brain create new connections. So we're actually creating new neural networks and connections, even possibly around the old ones that have been damaged. And since in MS the memory loss is generally because of plaque or damage to the nerve cells themselves, we actually create new nerve cells by activity, and so we can sometimes improve our memory that way. Some of the medications can also be helpful with memory, not just the antidepressants, but there are other types of things that can actually help with the brownout aspect. A medication named Provigil is one of the possibilities. Those medications can sometimes have some side effects and be unpleasant. Some of the ADD or attention deficit disorder drugs can be helpful because they increase activity in the brain, and that brings the energy level up a little bit. So maybe, again, a combination of looking at what medications might be available, talking to your doctor about that, and also being as active intellectually as you can be. And the things that are hardest for you are the things that you should spend the most time doing. They're the most frustrating, so we often don't want to do them. It's like, oh, I'm not good at puzzles, so I'm not going to do those. But it's the things that we're struggling with that we most need to work on, and it's often best to do that. One last thought about that. The one absolute in memory that always works, whether you're having memory difficulties or you have a normal functioning memory, is repetition. And if you're dealing with a cognitive deficit, memory difficulties, repetition is essential. And you may drive people crazy because you're repeating things over and over, but making sure that you keep notes, that you keep records, that you review the notes and records, and that if you're trying to take in something new, that you do many, many repetitions, doing the same thing over and over until it becomes habit. Because the habitual activity, you know, sliding into an activity that you've done over and over is much easier for the brain to do. And so what you want to do is set up something that you've repeated so often that your brain just automatically carries it out, and you don't have to use your memory stores to try to access it. Any other questions or comments?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if there's any questions or comments, please press the number one key on your phone now. there are no further questions in queue.
Okay.
I'd like to finish with one offer. If anyone who's listening would like to have some handouts from this, I would be happy to provide those for you. You can, the easiest way for me, because I don't really have someone who can do a lot of mailing, but if you have an email address, you can send me an email at my last name, it's D-I-D-D-E-L, at disability101.org, and I'd be happy to send you some handouts on some of this information so that you'll have it, and you can review it and use repetition to remember it.
Okay, again, thank you, Dr. Dedale, and thank you all for joining us in tonight's teleconference.
Good night, everyone.